Je suis en terrasse today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Parisians want their city back, so in the wake of last week's attacks on cafes and restaurants, many are making it a point to dine outside, en terrasse.
There is a sort of movement around Paris for everybody to be eating out at street cafes.
Also, a Syrian immigrant's message for U.S. governors who want to stop refugees from coming here.
We are the victim in all cases. We are not the threat. I mean, we need to repeat this and this again.
Meanwhile, this Scotsman readies the welcome mat for dozens of Syrian refugees.
We're going to have all these people from a different culture, different religions, and an opportunity to learn and hopefully form friendships with them as well.
Plus, is it ISIS or Daesh? That's coming up today on The World. Glad you could be with us today. We've got a lot of ground to cover in the aftermath of last week's attacks in Paris, the investigation and manhunt that have now spread to several European countries, what all this means for the war in Syria, also the political backlash against taking in Syrian refugees, both here and in Europe. We'll get to all of that in the next hour. We start in Paris. Time correspondent and friend of the show, Vivian Walt, is there. Vivian, we spoke with you on Friday night just as these horrible events were unfolding. How are you feeling now that a few days have passed?
It's very, very sad. I have to say, I think that it's a little bit sadder than it was a few days ago in the sense that, since then it's become clear to a lot of people in the city, and in fact the government has underlined this point, that this is far from over and that there's really absolutely no guarantees that this won't happen again, or even that this might be kind of a run-up to something worse. So I think there's been an awful lot to absorb and to think about, and an enormous amount of just open questions about where the country goes from here.
Something worse? Has anybody in the government suggested what that worse thing might be?
No, certainly not. I mean, they don't want to scare people any more than they're already scared, but it was interesting. I mean, the Prime Minister came out yesterday, shortly before that very high-profile speech of President Hollande, and he said, this will happen again. They have every capability of striking again, and it's almost inevitable that it will. Of course, it need not be Paris. It could be anywhere in Europe, but I think at this point it feels very much to people like Europe is bang in the middle of the crosshairs of ISIS. And then the second point, of course, is that for the very first time, Hollande and the government have used the word war on at least two occasions since Friday. And clearly they're kind of bracing the country for a long fight and a military fight. This really, in many ways, is a turning point.
I mean, that sense of a new reality, how does that translate on the streets of Paris and in the faces and behavior of people now, 3 days after this?
Well, superficially, if you looked at Paris, it looks just the same. People are out. In fact, they're defiantly out at street cafes. And tonight, there is a sort of movement around Paris for everybody to be eating out at street cafes. So, the cafes are spilling over. The parks are, relatively full. On Sunday was a gorgeous day. It felt like spring and the parks were full. However, that is very much on the surface. And if you scratch the surface and talk to people, people are very anxious and scared. You see that the moment there's any kind of sudden noise, for example. The friend was telling me she was on a bus which backfired and there was a big loud bang and everybody jumped 3 inches off their seats.
Wow. Let's talk about a couple of things that are still rolling in the news. The state of emergency across France, there was talk on Friday of closing all the borders. How long was that in effect? And what's up with French border control today?
I just spoke to a friend who went to Amsterdam yesterday, so she would have had to have crossed two European borders, the Belgian border and the Dutch border. She said she didn't have a single, identity check from one end to the other and back again, and didn't see any soldier or policeman anywhere. So clearly the system is extremely hard to implement and very patchy. And certainly the state of emergency, which is supposed to be in effect for just a couple of weeks, might now be in effect for a few months. President Hollande is asking the French Parliament to pass a kind of amendment in which would allow this state of emergency to continue and, in fact, give the police greatly expanded powers. So we will see how that plays itself out.
State of emergency equals greatly expanded powers for the police. Any more details what that means and what else a state of emergency actually entails?
Well, actually, the state of emergency, some of the regulations had in some ways been in operation since the Charlie Hebdo attacks. But now, with this particular national state of emergency, it means, for example, that the police can cordon off areas while they search buildings. They can search buildings without getting a court order. They can eavesdrop telephone calls with very perfunctory judicial warrant. They can do a whole range of measures which have been until now very much a no-no in France under laws of privacy and civil liberties. Mm.
What are the defenders of civil liberties in France? What do they have to say about all of this right now?
Oh, there's the most controversial thing that the president said yesterday, which did bring in a number of quite outraged comments from civil libertarians, was that he wanted an amendment to the Constitution of France. This amendment would give him essentially exceptional powers, or what was called exceptional measures, that the government would be able to take in order to crack down on threats to national security under extreme circumstances, this certainly being one of them.
Here in the U.S., Vivian, as you know, governors of various states are saying they're going to stop accepting refugees. How's that debate unfolding now in France? Is it empowering the far right?
Well, actually, the far right is rather, on the rise, as you know, in this country. And they came out afterwards and said, well, you know, we told you so. And everything the president is suggesting are things that we've been telling him for the last 2 years he has to do. In terms of the refugees, France has already been very wary of taking Syrian refugees and has really not taken many at all compared to Germany, for example. And this definitely would back the sort of sentiment that allowing in tens of thousands of Syrian refugees, or as Germany has done, hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees, could be asking for trouble, because someone within there, if not many someones, might have jihadist connections.
Time Magazine's Vivian Walt there in Paris. She'll be back later on The World to tell me about a piece of music that's been a source of comfort and solidarity for many since last Friday, the French national anthem, La Marseillaise. The solidarity in France following the attacks has been impressive. So have the efforts to put a face of courage and fearlessness. It's not easy, though, if you've lived through violence before and then this happens. And that's the case with my next guest. Sean James plays professional basketball in Bilbao, Spain. And Sean, your team Dominion Bilbao Basket is scheduled to play in Nanterre, west of Paris tonight. You decided to sit this one out. Can you tell us why?
Traveling to Paris was a little too soon for my liking. With everything that's going on right now in Paris, you know, it's only 2 days, and now I'm going to fly to a country that declared war and a state of emergency just to play a basketball game. You know, it didn't sit well with me.
Right, and I know your parents support you in this decision, and that's partly because you've seen violence before. You were a victim of a school shooting at Duquesne University when you were playing ball there in 2006. How did that experience factor into this decision not to play?
You know what? Maybe subconsciously it did. Maybe more so being a New Yorker, more than anything, played a factor into that. If you know it's a bad area, or you know crime is going on in that area, you're not just going to travel to that area, regardless of what you're traveling for. So I just wasn't going to go based strictly on basketball when I know the situation that's going on isn't resolved yet.
You're from New York, it sounds like?
Yes, Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah, so what was it like for you growing up? What kind of things did you see?
A lot. A lot of shooting, a lot of stabbings, a lot of violence. Just a lot of things that you shouldn't see at such a young age. It's kind of you know, in the 90s, early 2000s, that was kind of the Brooklyn way, and it still is to today. So, you know, those things played more of a factor for me not going to Paris more than anything else.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, allow me to put on my shrink hat here for a minute. Sounds like those childhood experiences are probably more impactful than what happened on Friday in Paris.
Absolutely, because, you know, the childhood experiences is something that you have to deal with on a daily basis. And being a kid, you have to live there. You have to, you know, you have to deal with your environment. You know, being an adult now and me knowing what's going on in Paris, I'm not just going to go to Paris to, you know, deal with all the police, deal with all the cameras and everything like that. I just wasn't going to put myself in that situation.
Mm. How did your team, Bilbao, react when you told them you would not be traveling?
You know what? I spoke to the coach and I spoke to the captain of the team. And, you know, a lot of guys on the team, you know, for their own reason, they felt similar to the way that I felt. But, you know, me, my upbringing and my experience are, you know, vastly different with everyone else on the team. So my experience just in that way is what made me, you know, just say I'm not going. It's not me trying to be a rebel or anything like that. I just have to put myself first and my well-being and my family well-being over everything else. And that's what I chose to do.
Do you think the people in Paris would understand your decision?
You know what? No, I don't think they will understand my decision because they have to live through it. Like, they just can't pick up and leave, you know? It's like what I was saying about Brooklyn. You know, I had to go through that and I had to stay there and deal with that. So the people of Paris that live there, they have to deal with that on a daily basis. So they wouldn't understand why I wouldn't want to come to Paris.
So I don't know what you lived through in Brooklyn when you were a kid, but in 2006, in that shooting at Duquesne, if I can summarize it, an argument broke out into a shooting and you got a bullet in your left foot. Given that experience, what words can you offer the people of Paris?
With time, everything heals, you know, and theirs is an unbelievable tragedy. So they're going to need more support and they're going to need more time. But, you know, on a smaller scale, it was 5 athletes. So the whole blood and the whole scrambling, I can relate in that sense. You know, people just shooting at you for no reason. I could relate in that way. We had the carnage and the bleeding and the shooting and all that, but we didn't have the death. So they have a lot more to deal with. So they're going to need time to heal and just try to get back to normalcy because it's hard. Everyone seems suspicious to you after a shooting like that. For me, I didn't feel safe in any environment after the shooting for a very long time.
Sean James plays professional basketball for Dominion Bilbao Basket in Bilbao, Spain. Great to speak with you, Sean. Thanks for your time.
No problem.
A quick look ahead before we take a break. What to call the so-called Islamic State? Some call it ISIS, others ISIL, and some refer to it by its Arabic acronym, Daesh. And if you think words don't matter in this case, think again.
The war of words matters just as much as the brutal acts that they commit. And we should be paying attention to the words as much as they are.
That story is coming up in a bit right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. The numbers keep growing. Both the number of Syrian refugees fleeing the violence in their war-torn nation and the number of governors here in the U.S. who don't want them coming here. The governors are citing security concerns in the aftermath of the Paris attacks. Officials in Europe are investigating whether one of the Paris gunmen posed as a refugee. One of those opposed to taking in Syrian refugees right now is Governor Charlie Baker here in Massachusetts. That's upsetting to Mohammed Al-Bardan. He's a Syrian who came to the U.S. to study at Northeastern University here in Boston.
It was so sad and unfortunate, to be honest, to hear this from Governor Baker. Politicians shouldn't be reactionaries. What happened in Paris is really a sad, heartbreaking event. But fighting terrorism is totally a different thing. It should be a systematic, not reactionary.
I totally see your position. Let me put myself in the shoes of Governor Charlie Baker for a moment, who's looking out and understands that the intelligence officials missed the attack on Paris. Isn't he just trying to protect the people of his state and maybe saying, all right, if I can't count on intelligence officials, I got to do this myself?
It's not a one-dimension problem. I mean, for sure, our duty here to protect this country, to protect the national security of it, and it is the first priority for all of us. But at the same time, we have other responsibilities. We can't turn our backs to the biggest humanitarian crisis since the Second World War. At the same time, the refugee settlements is already a very complicated process. More security background check is needed for sure after what happened in Paris. But the whole decision about accepting refugees or not, it's not even American. I totally understand all the concerns, but as a Syrian, I want to tell people like we're all or humans at the end, and we need to feel that.
What's it like for you to kind of have all Syrians painted with this brush of you're all a safety threat?
It's very difficult to express our emotions right now. I mean, we have faced like ourselves and our families, beloved friends, lots of terrorism actions, oppression by the government, and all the type of heartbreaking events. To see back that people are pointing at us at like we are the source of the problem. We are the victims of ISIS at the first place. ISIS have killed Syrians more than any other like nationalities in the world. And also we are the victims of dictatorship and oppression and the international community in action for the last 4 years and a half. So we are the victim in all cases. We are not the threat. I mean, we need to repeat this and this again. What happened in Paris, it's a terrorism action that has nothing to do with the refugee crisis.
Tell me about your parents. Where are they?
My parents and my sisters are still in Syria. They live in Damascus.
How are they? And are you worried that these attacks could prevent them, if they wanted to leave, from leaving?
They are relatively safe. They visited me during the last 2 years. They were able to grant visa after my graduation. After what happened in Paris, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to see them like in the meantime, either for me to be able to travel back. There's no way that they are going to grant a visa anymore.
I imagine that's pretty upsetting for you to suddenly be kind of caught in the consequences of the attacks in Paris.
It's really sad because we are the one who suffered from what happened during the last 4 years and a half. And my parents just suffered from losing many beloved ones around the country. And we're just seeing that we are being punished one more time right now.
Mohammed Al-Bardan, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your thoughts with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Mohammed Al-Bardan is a Syrian, now living and working here in Boston. By the way, later this week, I'll be moderating a panel, which I hope will highlight the perspectives of young Syrians like Mohammed. How would they rebuild Syria when that day finally comes? That discussion will be at Harvard on Thursday. If you're in the Boston area, I'd love to see you. But if you can't make it, we'll be streaming the discussion online. Find out more info on our Facebook page, facebook.com/PRI the world. We're going to hear now about a group of 15 Syrian families and the unlikely place in Scotland where they're going to be settling down, not mainland Scotland. These asylum seekers will take a ferry out to the island of Bute off the west coast of Scotland. Aidan Canavan runs the Bute Brewery. How do you feel about the Syrian refugee families coming to resettle in this island community of yours?
There's mixed emotions there. I've got concern for these people because they'll have lots of issues that they'll have to deal with when they get here.
Like
and
what?
I'm not just talking cultural issues, language issues, but they'll also have brought issues with them as well. But I'm also excited. I'm excited about the opportunity we're going to get on this island. We're going to have all these people from a different culture, different foods, different religions, and an opportunity to learn and hopefully form friendships with them as well. I also am very proud of the island and the way that we're responding to this. It's great to see so many people. There's over 50 volunteers now offering their time to help educate. It's amazing that our community has come together for this.
50 volunteers on an island of probably not that many people, I guess.
Well, we've got about 6,400, soon to be 6,500 people. So, yeah, it's good. I mean, the volunteer number is increasing as the word's getting out as well. So it's good. It's good to see.
I would guess Bute isn't exactly multicultural. There must be people there who are anxious, even opposed to taking in outsiders.
Of course there are. Of course there are. The community is split. There are some people who are very, very concerned. Scared. People are concerned about their own safety.
especially after what happened on Friday in Paris. There's people who feel that, you know, we should be looking after our own people before we're looking after other people. All these views have come out.
Yeah, so what do you tell neighbours of yours who think that way?
Well, I don't think they fully understand what's happening with these people. I don't think they fully understand that these are not economic migrants. These people are basically the same as us. They live, they work, and they're now in a country that's war-torn, and they have to leave. They're not leaving for a better life, they're leaving for a safe life. And, you know, if you're worried about them taking a home that you might have had, well, you know, at least you're lucky enough to live in safety. These people have lived in the fear of murder, torture, rape. I mean, why else would you jump in a rib, put your children in a rib at the threat of their life and just coming across the sea?
Mm.
You know, they're not leaving just to have a better opportunity. They're leaving because there was no other options.
I'm curious, how easy a decision was this for you to just welcome these newcomers to the island?
I was, before I was brewing, I worked as a teacher, and I was in Rwanda on a school trip. I took pupils over to Rwanda, and I didn't expect to see the level of human tragedy in Rwanda. I mean, I was there 10 years after the genocide, and it was still affecting people. I mean, everyone was affected. The scale of it was incredible, because I can remember watching it on the BBC News. I would have been 16, 17 at the time. I remember watching these people being bludgeoned, and I switched over. I changed the channel because, you know, it didn't connect with me. It didn't, you know, I was a 16-year-old boy. It just didn't register. I don't know why, if it's movies or whatever. Now, when I heard about what was happening in Syria and I saw these people in these boats coming across, I thought, you know, well, this is different. This stuff, it registered with me differently.
Yeah, you're not sitting back now and just turning the channel. Aidan Canavan, who runs a Bute brewery on the island of Bute in Scotland, thanks so much for telling us about what you and the people there are doing for the Syrian refugees. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
And this is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and the French national anthem La Marseillaise has helped rally the country in the wake of the Paris attacks. It's a rousing tune, but the truth is, it's pretty grim, too.
It could have been written by ISIS, really. It's just, it's a very bloodthirsty song.
What the Marseillaise is really all about, that's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There are so many strands to the investigation into last Friday's attacks in Paris, and so many angles to the aftermath of those tragic events, and we're spending this hour exploring many of them. And to start this half of the program, we're delving into a key question: where did the attackers get their high-powered weapons? Several Kalashnikov automatic rifles are found in an abandoned car that's been linked to the attackers. British journalist and author Misha Glenny studies global organized crime. He says most of the illegal arms in Europe come from smuggling networks created during the Balkan Wars more than two decades ago.
We have a very interesting indication in the latest case surrounding the Paris attacks, which was the arrest in southern Germany a week before the attacks took place of a man who was driving a car filled with semi-automatic weapons and grenades and bound for Paris, it appears. And he was from Montenegro. Now, German media are not allowed to publish the names, the surnames of people who've been arrested, but they were able to publish his first name, Vlatko, a Montenegrin Christian name. That is, it's an Orthodox Christian name. So he was clearly not from the Muslim minority in Montenegro, who are largely Albanians. He was from what looks like to be a standard Balkan syndicate that was sending weapons up to Paris just at the time when the Islamist terrorists had put in a big order for them.
If a terrorist in Europe wants an automatic assault rifle, how easy is it to get and where do they usually turn?
The bulk of the weaponry comes from the Balkans, the former Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Albania. And the reason why it does is, of course, it harks back to the 1990s where we had the very bloody and chaotic civil war in the former Yugoslavia. And this was in large measure in various areas a Kalashnikov war. At the end of the war, there were some 4 to 5 million semi-automatic weapons sloshing around the Balkans, and the criminal trading syndicates that had emerged during the war, selling drugs and trafficking women for sexual purposes and smuggling untaxed cigarettes into the European Union, were then switched and used in order to send weapons up to Northern Europe, mainly for drug syndicates, but they are available on the open black market for anyone who wants them.
We hear so much about the tough gun control laws across Europe. How did this black market for guns manage to skirt those laws?
Well, you have an open border policy for much of the European Union, and that means it's easy to ship guns from, say, Italy to France or Austria to Germany and into Belgium. So once you get it across the European Union border, then you can basically get it almost anywhere on the continental European Union. You can't get it into the country where I live, the United Kingdom, so easily because they do not have the same open borders. So you have tougher police controls. But there were so many of these weapons that the price came down pretty rapidly. And you can now get an AK-47 for between $300 and $500, roughly speaking, on the black market.
How many automatic weapons, high-powered weapons, are floating around Europe for sale to whomever? Do officials have an estimate?
Hundreds of thousands is their guesstimate, based on the number of fines they have and their monitoring of the prices on the black market, which is probably the most accurate way of doing it.
Misha Glenny, the author of the just-published Nemesis, One Man in the Battle for Rio. Misha, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Here's another question we've been pondering since the attacks last week. Is it ISIS or Daesh? The extremist group most people call ISIS calls itself the Islamic State, but French officials and many in the Mideast have long referred to it as Daesh, and lately so does U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
One thing is certain. Daesh will continue to spread until or unless it is stopped.
The term Daesh has been in use for a while among Arabic speakers, according to Zeba Khan. She writes about Islam and politics, and more than a year ago, she wrote a story for the Boston Globe titled, Words Matter in ISIS War, So Use Daesh.
Daesh is actually the Arabic acronym for ISIS. It stands for al-Dawal al-Islamiyya fi al-Iraq wa al-Sham, which essentially means the Islamic State in Iraq and Greater Syria. And the reason why it adds value to this conversation, as opposed to the terms that we're normally used to, is that it can also be understood as a play on words, alluding to more derogatory descriptions of the group. And those derogatory descriptions include things like to trample or crush, or a bigot who imposes their view.
So what does ISIS, which is the term I've come to use to describe this group, what does ISIS want to be called?
Nowadays, they want to be called Islamic State, or IS. And this really we should pause and think about, because the fact that they've changed their name so many times, going back to 1999, if you go all the way back, but even from 2013, where they were ISIS, and then in 2014, dropped the second two letters and just became Islamic State, that tells us a lot about their goals, which are really aspirational goals about seeing a broad Islamic State, not limited by region or country. And these are goals that the United States government unequivocally rejects, as do our allies. My point is basically that the U.S. should be leaning into the narrative and the worldview of the people that we're supporting and not the narrative of the terrorists.
So you wrote this article about the word Daesh more than a year ago. What's been happening in the last 12 months, and how do you account for why many in the West continue to refer to the group as ISIS, and now there's this new trend to calling them Daesh?
France has actually been a leader on this outside of the Middle East. France has been calling the terrorist Daesh since last year. Since then, Australia as well has taken up the term, as has Turkey. But more important to me than any of those states is the fact that the people on the ground who face a daily brunt of brutality from these terrorists, they call them Daesh. There's a very strong literary history in the Middle East that goes back centuries. And the mechanisms of allusion and double meaning, there's a very strong tradition of that in the region. And if you put that in context of the fact that many people in the region have lived under brutal authoritarian regimes and have not been able to speak their mind, double meaning becomes all the more important.
When was the term Daesh actually coined, and who coined it?
It was coined in 2013 by a Syrian activist. His name was Khaled Al-Haj Saleh, and it's been picked up through the media. It's also something you'll see, it's popular in satirical form as well in the Middle East. Again, playing on the idea that you can use double meaning. Mm.
Now, I'm told that Daesh is just one letter different from the Arabic word Daes. What does Daes mean?
Daesh, I believe it means to tread on. Daesh is based on a three-letter root system, and classical Arabic, also classical Hebrew for that matter, work in this way where it has three basic letters, and from those letters you can conjugate into many different forms. If you add certain vowels, which sometimes are just dots, it can change the meaning. And if you do that with the base root of the letters that form Daesh, you can come up with a lot of double meanings that have very negative connotations.
Well, as you said, words matter when you write. Why was it important for you that we call this group Daesh?
Because I think it gets to the longer haul view of what's going on. The group is keenly aware that the war of words matters just as much as the brutal acts that they commit. And we should be paying attention to the words as much as they are. If the United States government uses ISIS or ISIL, which is what the Obama administration officially uses, then we're essentially giving them and their worldview legitimacy.
Zeba Khan writes about Islam and politics. Thanks very much for your time, Zeba.
Thank you.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for bringing down a Russian airliner last month in Egypt. Russia had resisted calling it a terrorist attack, but today Russian officials acknowledged that it was a bomb that brought down the Metrojet plane, killing all 224 on board. They offered a $50 million reward to anyone with information that leads to an arrest, and President Vladimir Putin promised to bring the victims justice.
Мы будем искать их везде.
We will find them, said Putin, in any place on Earth and punish them. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. You've been speaking with people in St. Petersburg, Charles, where many of the victims on the Metrojet flight were from. What kind of reactions have you heard?
Well, I think there's a sense that this was, first of all, a very similar kind of deja vu moment for some of them, because if you go back through Putin's career, you know, he's had these moments before where he's sort of put out tough talk against terrorism. So I spoke, for example, with Boris Vishnevsky, who's a local deputy there in St. Petersburg, and obviously has been in contact with a lot of the families of the victims from Metrojet. And he said that essentially this was just the same thing all over again. But he does feel as though, you know, it's odd that the Kremlin for so long wanted to kind of believe that this was sort of this crash was due to a technical error. And he explains it just in the sense that the more that you kind of embrace this terrorism theory, it became more obvious to the public that this was payback for what up till now has been essentially a kind of sort of an easy war through their air campaign in Syria, bombing what the Kremlin says are ISIS targets.
Vladimir Putin forged his reputation getting tough with terrorism in 1999. And since then, Russia has had repeated problems with terrorism. I'm thinking of some of the parallels with the Bataclan Theater in Paris with that seizure in 2002 of the theater in Moscow.
That's right. That's when you had basically about 40 Chechen fighters storm the Moscow theater during a musical production. They took over 800 people hostage. There was a long standoff with the Russian authorities. Eventually, the Russians did storm the theater by pumping gas through the vents. That killed the attackers, but it also killed more than 130 spectators. So it was a very controversial action at the time, although it did save a lot of lives. And it should be said that the U.S. embraced it. And I actually spoke with a woman today, Tatiana Karpova, whose son Alexander was killed in the attack, just to ask her about, you know, what she felt in relation to the Paris attacks as well. And what she's saying here is essentially that in Russian is that, you know, the government never took responsibility for anything back then. The families were really on their own. If she kind of was sort of amazed to look at sort of the outpouring of support you've seen here in Moscow and some of the other cities for the victims of the Paris attacks. You know, people have brought flowers to the French embassy, to the French consulate in St. Petersburg as well. And, you know, of course, she's encouraged by that, but it's also a slightly bitter experience because for them, they felt like they got nothing. They were told by the Russian authorities at the time that they couldn't help them, that they had no financial support to give them. And if they wanted any, you know, to talk to anybody, they should talk to the families of the Chechen terrorists who had committed the act to begin with.
Yeah, some other eerie echoes of Paris with the siege of that theater, the people in the days after that siege searching hospitals as they are right now in Paris.
Well, see, it's interesting, even right now, I mean, they also, speaking with Ms. Karpova today, she said that, you know, for example, there was just no information at all. So they were just hunting around Moscow, trying to find their loved ones. And, you know, Moscow's a big city of 15 million people. You can spend a lot of time doing that.
Yeah. So what happens next, Charles? Putin is talking about a grand alliance against ISIS. How realistic is that, given that Russia and the U.S. just a couple of weeks ago were scrambling plans to avoid an accidental bombing or collision with each other in the air?
Well, that's right. Putin has kind of come out of these talks in Turkey over the weekend calling for, once again, for this grand alliance. He made the same sort of argument during his pitch speech at the UN in the fall. Question is how realistic that really is. One problem they face is, frankly, that the Russians have been beating the sort of anti-Western drum here for quite some time over the past 2 years. And it suddenly is sort of, it's almost like if you judge Russian news today, you would say that, you know, the Russia's main enemies are the U.S. and ISIS. And in fact, a lot of the arguments are made that the U.S. funds and sponsors ISIS. So for the Kremlin to suddenly make this kind of pivot and suddenly say that we're with the U.S. on this front is a big question.
I can't let you go without following up on that kind of notion that the U.S. might be funding ISIS. Who's spreading those rumors?
State TV. So that's a problem.
Another day on State TV. Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
A lot of attention since Friday has been fixed on Paris and the aftermath of the attacks there. Other news continues to happen, obviously, and before a station break, I want to go through just a handful of those other stories. From West Africa, we heard earlier this month about Sierra Leone being declared Ebola-free. That's still not the case for its West African neighbor, Guinea, but there is some good news from Guinea this week. Health officials there say the country's last known Ebola patient, a 20-day-old baby, has recovered from the disease. The infant remains under surveillance. Now Guinea needs to go more than 42 days without new Ebola cases in order to be declared Ebola-free, joining Liberia and Sierra Leone. Elsewhere in Africa, some more good news. Five miners in Tanzania who'd been trapped underground for over a month have finally been rescued. Not quite the drama of the 33 in Chile. There's a new movie out about them. But then again, even a day trapped in a mine is more than most of us can fathom. In India, the news is not so good. A week of torrential rains in the southern state of Tamil Nadu has caused widespread flooding. More than 70 people have died, and the Indian government has had to deploy its military to rescue residents who were hit by the flood. In Britain, the weather is also a concern. Forecasters there say a storm named Barney is getting ready to hit the British Isles with winds of up to 80 miles per hour. And then two stories from Latin America that caught our eye. Nicaragua has turned back hundreds of Cuban migrants. The migrant crisis in this hemisphere. The government in Managua says these Cubans stormed into the country from Costa Rica on Sunday. The Cubans were reportedly trying to travel north to the United States by land. Apparently, some in Cuba fear that improving ties between Cuba and the U.S. could lead Washington to tighten entry requirements for Cuban migrants. And finally, the president of Colombia says he's getting ready to sign a decree legalizing marijuana for medical use. That would put Colombia in line with other Latin American countries that have taken steps to legalize pot, except few of those other countries have had as much trouble with drug-related violence as Colombia. So people in Colombia wondering how this new chapter in drug acceptance is going to work out. I'm Marco Werman with The World. One of the targets in the Paris attacks last Friday was a soccer stadium. Three suicide bombs went off outside the facility as the national teams of France and Germany faced off inside. Tens of thousands of people attending the game heard the blasts. Today, all eyes were on the French team again as they took the field in London for their next match against England. Normally, there's no love lost between French and English soccer fans. This time, it was different. Both sets of fans in the stadium belted out the French national anthem in unison. The lyrics to La Marseillaise were displayed for all to follow on big screens in the stadium. It was a touching way to honor the victims in Paris. But if you really stop to listen to those lyrics, the original meaning of the Marseillaise might surprise you.
It could have been written by ISIS, really. It's just, it's a very bloodthirsty song.
That's Time magazine's Vivian Walt in Paris. La Marseillaise was written when France was fighting a war against the Austrians and Prussians. The first verse warns of ferocious soldiers coming to cut French throats. Vivian says not surprising, given the context.
You know, this is a song that was written around, you know, the revolutionary times, and it absolutely is a war song, but so are many national anthems, in fact. And a lot of French people would say that they far prefer to sing the European anthem these days, which is Ode to Joy.
Has the Marseillaise actually kind of divided France in the last few days?
No, I would say it's actually done the opposite. I mean, it's become almost a cliche. You turn on any French television channel and the Marseillaise is playing out the newscast. It ended the minute of silence that the whole country engaged in yesterday at noon. And my kid came home from school singing it. So clearly it was being sung in French schools. And there is a tremendous feeling of patriotism. Of course, it won't be long before that wears off.
Why do you think that? This was such a, as many people have said, this was a watershed attack.
Well, I think because, you know, deep down, this is something of a divided country. Despite what happened on Friday, we have the most unpopular president in French history, if you go by the opinion polls. And I think that once the shock has worn off and people get back to thinking about the economy and, you know, the endemic unemployment will certainly come to the surface again.
As for the game between France and England, do you know if there was any kind of concern about playing it at all?
I think it was regarded as a little bit of an act of a show of resilience, shall we say, or a show of defiance that they were not going to be scared into cancelling it. And I imagine that the security will be very tight. But one should actually remember that the suicide bombers who blew themselves up next to the National Stadium here in Paris actually couldn't get into the stadium. There was at least one that did have a ticket to the game and he was blocked from getting in. So, you know, in some macabre way, I guess you could say that that was a little bit of a security success.
That was Vivian Walt with Time Magazine in Paris. Very unconventional treatment of the French national anthem by the always unconventional Serge Gainsbourg, his Aux Armes, etc. from 1979. Finally today, even after an attack like the one that Paris suffered on Friday, things start to return to normal. People go back to their lives, they get on trains, they go to work, they shop. Our own Adeline Sia went to a market in Paris that reopened today for the first time since the attacks.
Whenever I'm in Paris, I head to the Marché d'Aligre. This is a farmer's market, one of the icons of the neighborhood that was attacked last week. It's in the 12th district, right on the border with the 11th. The market's a very popular place, surrounded by cafes and cheese shops, butcher shops, fishmongers and hardware stores that sell items you won't find anywhere else. There's a little flea market on the side, too. It's just great to walk around and sample the fruit and vegetables that vendors are always eager to make you try. There are mangoes from Madagascar, dates from Algeria, oranges from Tunisia, as well as beautiful mushrooms from central France. The market has a real North African flavor, not only because of the fruit sold here. Almost every vendor is of North African descent. Usually, you have to push your way through the crowds here, but not today. I can't remember ever seeing a clear path down the street lined with vendors. Iskander Dridi is trying to get the attention of potential customers on the street. He's a vegetable vendor here. Dridi's parents are Tunisian, but Iskander is a Parisian, a true product of this neighborhood. He was born at the hospital around the corner from here. He lives a few blocks away from the market, went to school farther down the street. His father ran his vegetable stall before him, and Dridi kept the spot after he retired. Dridi sells his produce at the Aligre market every day, except Mondays when the market is closed. But after the Friday attack, Paris authorities banned public gatherings. So many vendors showed up here at 4 a.m. on Saturday, produce in hand, only to be told they could not open their stalls. The market was closed for 2 days. I asked Dridi if that had ever happened before.
Jamais. Jamais.
Never. Never, he says.
Jamais, même pas après Charlie.
not even after the Charlie Hebdo attack last January. Dridi says he walked by the Belle Équipe Café on Rue de Charonne 20 minutes before it was attacked on Friday night. He says he feels very lucky that no one he knows personally got hurt, but he still thinks the market should have opened as usual the next day. And he says so in English.
We can't be afraid. No, we can't. They can change us. We have to live like any day.
Valérie Xaé lives around the block from the market with her family and comes here nearly every day. But today, it wasn't an easy walk.
I had to push myself out of the house today. But if we stop doing things, they will win. So I don't want this. I'm scared, but I don't want them to win.
Besides, Xaé says she feels a need to show her support for the Muslim vendors she knows here.
To express that we don't mix everybody together. I mean, a really religious person would not kill anyone. No religion says to kill people.
Another vendor here, Mohamed Amdi, was born in Tunisia. He has grown children who live around the 11th district, and he was very worried about them on Friday. He says vendors like him lost a lot of money over the 2 days the market was closed. We all lost, he says. But I'm looking at people in their 20s enjoying a drink at a cafe and losing their life. That is so much more than money. For the World, I'm Adeline Cyr, Marché des Ligres, Paris.
And I'm Marco Werman from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for being here.
PRI, Public Radio International.